Gorgeous Lives on Radio Gorgeous. Today I'm here on Radio Gorgeous with a woman who's passionate about dance, the theatre, her family, the piano, interior design and travel. She is Princess Josephine Lowenstein, and she's written a collection of life memories and made them into a book, which has just been published, called Wind in My Hair. Hi, Josephine. Welcome to Radio Gorgeous.
Good morning. Hello.
So, Josephine, you've had an amazing life. You've met the good, the great and the beautiful, and now you've decided to share it with the public. Why is that?
Well, I started writing short stories some years ago, really because of the extraordinary things that happen along the way. And I thought if I don't write them down, they'll never be known. Funny things that children said and all that sort of thing.
So let's start at the beginning. You were born into the aristocracy, your mother was an honourable, and you were brought up in the war by your grandparents in a house in Ledbury called Ledbury Park.
My earliest memories were in the Isle of Wight when I was small. We used to go there a lot. And the war was declared while we were on the beach. And then everybody rushed down from the house and said, we have to leave at once. So I suppose they thought they were going to bomb the country immediately. And then we went to my grandparents, who's actually at Ledbury, Herefordshire.
Yeah.
And I spent the war there.
And what were conditions like then?
Well, very grim indeed. I mean, extremely cold. No question of central heating or anything of that sort. Long passages, freezing cold. The food was all right then, but when the rationing really started, there was very little food. If you were growing, you know. So it was a bit grim.
Tell me about your parents had, they were still kind of old-fashioned in a way that they had lots of staff. Can you tell us how many they had?
Well, I suppose, let me try and think. I suppose about 10 indoor servants had their own dining room with their own plasmore.
So like Downton Abbey?
A bit.
Yeah,
not so quite so grand as that. But of course, in Downton, they didn't have nearly enough servants for a house of that size.
Oh, really? When you watched it, you realised
that? Oh, well,
of
course.
Yeah.
Yes, I suppose we did. And then in the garden, I suppose there were about six, head gardener. And
did you, I know you had a nanny. Did you ever talk to the other staff, or was it just the kind of nanny?
Oh, yes.
Oh,
but
you did?
We were kept pretty separate, really.
From your grandparents, all the staff?
Well, the staff, really. I mean, it was a different sort of department, as it were.
Mm-hmm.
But I had a series of nannies and series of governesses.
So you didn't go to school?
I did. Went to boarding school in the war.
Okay. Yes, in the end, what, like at about 11?
Yes, exactly. Mm. And their conditions were really grim. That was almost Dickensian with the cold, you know. Everybody had chilblains and... I don't know.
Horrible food and...
Oh, well.
What was the education like?
Not very good. Very arty. The headmistress was very keen on poetry, so we had to recite poetry.
Well, that's quite good.
Well, it was, in a way.
Mm.
And the musical side was quite good.
Excellent.
But the discomfort was the cold and the windows opened in the dormitory, you know, at night. And I remember the snowflakes drifting in through the window. That sort of thing.
Unbelievable. Mm. Now, you didn't live with your mother, and you describe her as one of the most eccentric women you've ever met. Was there a reason you didn't live with her, apart from the war?
Well, she was there in the war, yes.
Oh,
I lived with her.
She was at the house?
She was.
Okay.
She was, yes. And she did quite a lot of war work. She was quite good. And
what was war work then for a woman? What sort of?
Well, in London, it was ARP, which was... going out in the streets and helping people into the air raid shelters and getting ambulances for them and, you know, things like that.
That's very brave.
Yeah. Yes, they all had to do that, really, unless they were unable, you know, or too old or something.
Now, I'm interested in your relationship with your mother, because she does sound like a kind of quite a difficult woman. Can you tell us?
Well, I'm afraid so, yes, she was, yes. Well, no, of course I was very fond of her, but she was very, very beautiful indeed, and been so much admired, and got rather spoilt, I think. But clever, read a lot, but not a maternal person, I'd say.
That's such a shame. And then your parents got divorced when you were really young, which, again,
well,
must have been...
my father left when I was about three, I think, and they got divorced when I was about 5 years old, yes.
But that must have been unusual in those days as well.
Well, that was when it was all beginning, really. But they didn't put up with a thing. They went off in a minute. Mm-hmm. 20s and 30s, they got rather like that.
They realised, I suppose, after the Great War, time was short.
Yes, yeah. Absolutely. Mm. And they were intent on having a good time, and they weren't going to put up with anything. Mm-hmm. And I didn't know that they divorced, because nobody told me. So the girls told me in boarding school.
Oh, no.
And it was rather a shock. Because in those days, people didn't really speak to you if your parents were divorced at school. That was you were very tainted then, if you see what I mean.
How awful, how awful. No, I mean, I'll never forget, because my parents divorced in the 60s, and, you know, people used to whisper, her parents are divorced, you know, like it was like, that's why she's like she is, or, you know what I mean? You know, or it was like, I agree with you. It was
yes,
a horrible feeling.
Horrible.
So you felt left out, you felt hurt. How did you manage with your sort of loneliness?
Well, the loneliness was really because when there were holidays, I was in the house with the grandparents and that, there was no petrol, you see, so you couldn't go anywhere. Or what about once every 2 months we went a trip like to Cheltenham or somewhere like that, Hereford. And so you couldn't really have anyone to stay because they couldn't get there unless they were on the train, someone to bring them and all that sort of thing. It was awful to say it, but the children at school, if I asked them around, they were too sort of a bit overwhelmed by the whole thing.
Oh.
You see what I mean?
It
was awful to say that, but yeah. it rather spoiled things.
But then what, you found solace in ballet and dance, didn't you? That's how you kind of found yourself.
I went to the Basel Ballet before the war, when there's the three ballerinas, very young ones, you know, 15 or so. And I was so struck by it, and I thought, that's what I'm going to do. But and then I went to dance classes in Ledbury. But I was too tall, you know, not then, but later.
We'll get to that later. But obviously you found something in dance that kind of kept you going, didn't it?
Oh, lovely. I loved it. Loved the music and everything, yes.
You must have been very talented, because then you were accepted by a dance school in London.
Ninette de Valois, yes.
Yes, who was very famous. Can you tell us about her?
Well, she was just very formidable indeed, yes. Everyone was terrified of her. Very beautiful. And I had a audition at the new, what was called the New Theatre. I don't know what it's called now, but and I had the audition, came up from Ledbury, and then she said, I'll take you in a year and a half or something. So that was nice.
That was fantastic.
And it was at the Sadler's Wells Theatre then.
Wow. And was that in the same place in Rosebery Avenue?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
And the school was there, you see. Mm-hmm. And then we had the opening of Covent Garden about a year and a half later, 2 years later.
And were you a ballerina in that?
Well, I wasn't a ballerina, no. I only just took part in it. You know, the students were brought in, some of us.
Mm-hmm. Like as extras sort of thing?
Sort of, a bit like that.
Yeah, yeah.
And then later...
And were you living at your mum's then?
Then we were living in Chelsea. Mm-hmm. The house she bought when she got bored in the country. And the bombs were falling all around and everything. But it didn't occur to me to be frightened of it. I don't know why.
Wow.
Yes, they were the doodle bugs. You know,
so you literally were there during the doodle bugs?
Yes.
Amazing.
Did you hear them coming, you know.
Did you see anything horrific?
No, only a bomb damage was terrible. It was everywhere. Heaps of houses all crashed down. And that was amazing, actually.
Mm-hmm. Did they hit Chelsea or not?
I don't think so, no. No.
Mm-hmm. You're very lucky.
Very, very lucky.
So you were so good at dance that you kind of you made friends, you started to have really good fun, and then you started to get auditions, didn't you? And you ended up going on tour.
Yes, I went. I went into the opera ballet because it didn't matter being tall so much for that. And then we went on tour with the opera.
And that must have been a real eye-opener after living quite a kind of sheltered life, you know.
Yes, it was. It was very difficult to persuade my mother to let me go, but in the end she did. Yeah, so six of us went.
And you stayed in the boarding houses
all day? Boarding houses, yeah. Yes, absolutely. Theatrical digs.
Fascinating. Now, you also said you were frightened that people would find out who you were. So were you aware of class, and did you not want them to know that, you know, you were an aristocrat?
So leading a double life, you mean?
Mm.
No, I didn't want them to. No, I didn't.
Why? What did you think they'd judge? What did you think they'd think?
Well, I wanted to be thought of as a professional dancer, which I was. I didn't want to have any kind of other life but that, really. But then I had the pressure on the other side and to have a coming out ball and all those things that you had to do, you know, if you were in that kind of world. So I did it all, but I managed to keep it separately.
Gosh, that's really interesting. So you learnt to have, as you say, a double life.
Yeah.
And then a coming out ball, what year was that then?
I think that was 1947.
So that's when you were definitely presented to the Queen or the King. Was it a king then?
By then we were, there was a garden party.
Okay.
You went to the garden party.
Yeah.
And then there were a lot of other balls, you see, at least two a week, debutante balls here.
Did you enjoy it?
Not very much, no.
You just went through with it?
Well, you went through with it, yes. Yeah. Some of the balls were beautiful if they were in country houses, you know. But in London, they were mostly in hotels, like a Hyde Park Hotel, Claridge's or something like that. Yes.
Well, and they were a little bit dull, really.
Rather dull.
Because your heart was in the theatre.
Yes, that's right.
Fabulous. Now, you say, yeah, you kind of danced for a while, you did this, and then you had to come to terms of you were too tall to become an actual ballerina, so you decided to stop. That must have been one of the most heartbreaking moments of your life.
I suppose it was the most heartbreaking, yes, possibly. As I didn't, I could have gone into shows, you know. I went in one, the pantomime, which I think I've written about, because they had a classical ballet in it. So I was in that, and but I didn't want to do shows. Didn't interest
not like
me.
Like I know, but I've had a friend, and she had to go. She went to Paris and danced there. Sort
well,
of.
Well, there you are.
It's all about kind of long legs and kicking and things.
That's right. No, I didn't want that at all.
No,
not same thing.
Not your thing.
No, no.
So what did you decide to do?
Well, it was a pretty bad time, really, frankly. My mother was not really able to keep house very well, or she couldn't cook and all that. And I got didn't really have enough to eat and this and that and the other, and there was no money. And so my father decided to buy a house, and I would live with him in, that was in Montpelier Square, or the nice, sort of opposite Harrods. And so he bought a house, and I went and lived with him, and my mother was terribly upset about all that. And that was not...
Were you happier with your dad?
Yes.
What, because it wasn't as kind of unpredictable?
Yes, and of course she lived really on row. She needed row all the time, you know. And if there wasn't one, she'd provoke you into a scene of some sort and...
Probably nowadays you'd say she was suffering from a mental health problem, but then it wasn't, you know, she'd probably be so helped nowadays. You know, she obviously had some sort of condition.
If she would have gone to anyone, which she wouldn't. Which she wouldn't.
Always the people that need it never go, as we know.
She said everybody must stand on their own feet, she said.
Yeah.
She didn't approve of religion at all, because she said it was like a crutch for people. They should stand on their own feet.
She also didn't like things like vacuum cleaners and, I mean, electricity. It was
no
quite
machines
strange.
Of any kind.
Yeah. Your mum had this, mother had this Bakelite phone.
Well, a very heavy old phone.
Yeah.
And that was all. No fridge. No, I mean, you can't, any machine you think of, she wouldn't have.
You also went round and one time she had the clock on the ground, and you asked her what that was about.
Yes, well, she had a mouse in the kitchen, and she had this old clock, which wasn't working anymore, so the hands were static. I mean, it made a tick-tock noise. She put it in front of the hole, the skirting board, and I said, "What's that doing there?" And she said, "Oh, that's to keep the mouse away."
So I said, why can't you have a trap like anybody else?
And she said, no, she thought that was cruel and she couldn't possibly do that. What would she do with it afterwards? You see the picture?
See, I'm wondering whether she was, as you say, she was very intelligent and in those days she just wasn't fulfilled. You know, she'd had something to use her brain, it sounds
so
like.
Right. Yeah. You're so right. Mm. She was very, very amusing, very witty.
Yeah.
And she probably now worked
on a magazine or done something like that and been really good.
She was really, really independent and wouldn't
she was really modern in a way.
I suppose so.
Yeah.
She wouldn't do anything anybody suggested. Absolutely not. Mm. Had to be her plan, which was good in a way.
But difficult to be...
To live with.
Yeah, and you were the only daughter, yes. So the only daughter, there's a lot of pressure on you, isn't there?
Yes. Mm. Mm. Yes, that's right.
So, you went on holiday to Rome, and you were meant to go for 10 days, but how long did you stay?
Well, I stayed overall about 3 years, I suppose, but not directly then, but coming and going.
And that was when Rome literally was the, I mean, and we know it's the Eternal City, but it was the most fashionable city in the world.
Yes, it was
a happening place. So can you tell us, after the grimness, the greyness, the blackness of post-war England, what it was like arriving in Rome?
Well, the thing was that it was the climate, of course, first and foremost.
So it was coming, sunny.
I know, wonderful. And the train coming in at dawn, you know, and it's warm and the beautiful buildings, and it was quite wonderful.
And what about the food and drink? Because that must have been
Oh, that was absolutely perfect in all the restaurants and that sort of thing. But where I lodged, it was rather sparse, really, yes.
Was it a place where kind of ladies stayed?
Yes, girls who were studying, you know, and wanted to be there for a few months or something. And then my landlady, the Neapolitan one, she had to make a bit of money because she was very, very short of it. And there were one or two other girls there on and off, you know. It was very nice.
And did you fall in love with an Italian man?
Well, when I did, yes, I did eventually.
Good reason to stay then.
Well, yes, good reason to stay. You're so right. Yeah, absolutely.
And you learnt Italian?
I learned Italian fairly early on. I studied it in London. I taught myself the grammar and everything like that. But it was difficult to learn a language, to go out with people in the evening and talk.
Yes, I know. You know the kind of basics, but have real fast conversation is such a different thing.
Very difficult. Yeah. But in the end, after some months, I managed to do it. And it's been very useful, as I've got an Italian son-in-law. So it's been very, it's a lovely language.
It's marvellous, marvellous. Mm. So you stayed there and then you came back to Britain and then you met your husband, who was a prince, and his name was Rupert Lowenstein. And he came from obviously a very upper crust background, but he had no money as well. This seems to be a theme in the book.
Right.
Do you think it was kind of post-war, just people just didn't have anything?
It was pre-war. They had to leave, you see, when the Nazis took power.
Ah, is that when they left then?
Right.
Germany?
My father-in-law left in 1928, and his uncle left some little time later, late 30s, I think.
And so lucky to have got away.
And so they lost all their property, all their money, everything. You see, you couldn't leave with anything. And they had to get out as quickly as they could.
So he had to start from scratch, but your husband was very clever. He went to Cambridge, is that right?
He went to Cambridge and he studied there, and then he got a scholarship to Oxford, Magdalen, and medieval history. And he was very, very clever, yes, indeed.
So how did you meet him and fall in love?
Well, I met him in when he was at Oxford, actually, sharing rooms with Desmond Guinness, who was who was head of the Irish Georgian Society, mm-hmm. well, what later was.
Yeah.
Yes. Saving the buildings there, you know. Yeah. Well, yes, and we married in 1957. I married for 57 years.
Wow, that's amazing. It's brilliant. So you then gave birth to two gorgeous boys with German names, Conrad and Rudolf, yes. and you lived in Holland Park, which was run down then, which is very hard for us to imagine.
I know, it was. And we were first in St. Leonard's Terrace in Chelsea, which was a leasehold. It wasn't freehold. I think it was leasehold.
Those were the days. Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
And then it was very small, you know, those little terrace houses, one room on each floor. And so we thought we'd buy a bigger house. But it was very, very inexpensive. On Holland Villas Road, it was very nice. Oh, now it's, well, up the top, isn't it?
Now, because you've been brought up with staff, you've carried on having staff. So did you have staff then?
We did in Chelsea. We had, yes, we did. But we had a cook and then a daily cleaner. Yes.
And then did you have a nanny for the boys?
I did. My own nanny I'd had before.
Wonderful.
Yes. Yeah, she stayed till they were at school.
Gosh, so she must have been quite old by then.
Well, she was very young when my mother took her on for me. Okay. She was very, very young in those days. Mm. And that was considered a bit risky. But she was very, very wonderfully solid.
Now, you described, which I really like in the book, their uniforms. Can you tell us about nannies? Because you said they were kind of a breed apart.
Yes, they were. They were. I think they're quite famous all over the world, aren't they? In fact, I think that there was some sort of society that went to Russia to save them when the revolution came. Somebody.
Well, the English nannies over there.
But yes, English nannies and governesses, yes, because they were stranded, right? Mm-hmm. You know, the revolution. Mm. So they've been going in all countries, really, I think.
Yeah. Mm. And you said that they always had the same day off and they always wore the same clothes.
Yes, they did. Yes, grey. Mm. With thick stockings and walking shoes. Always hat, gloves. And the children always in hats and gloves.
I know, I couldn't believe when I read that. So your sons wore white gloves when they went to the park?
They did.
Unbelievable.
It's unbelievable, yeah, isn't it? I can hardly believe it now. Oh, yes.
So it was quite a formal time, was it?
Very formal. Well, compared to now.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah. Well, the 60s hadn't happened yet, had they?
No, the 60s came in.
Exactly,
my goodness.
Exactly, and completely changed things. Now, you and your husband, he bought a bank or worked for a bank, which was always a good idea if you want to make money. And you loved socialising. And in your book, you describe yourself as hanging around in cafe society. Can you explain who these people were and what's their lifestyle?
It's difficult to say, but they generally were like the top of the tree, very rich, with a lot of money, houses, everything like that. And they tended to do the same things, always go to the same holiday places. And they wore grand clothes and they had specially made and all that sort of thing. Went to the same parties and the same balls, and it was like that, really.
Now, what's really interesting is you said you went to these kind of events, but you often found them stultifyingly dull, which actually we all want to hear that. We all want to hear, because we weren't there. You tell us, in what way was it sometimes? Was it the superficiality or just the boring thing about always talking about tittle-tattle and sort of...
Yes, very much so, that, I think. Mm-hmm. But on the other hand, it was very comfortable and very wonderful food and beautiful works of art to look at and all that sort of thing. I think in France I found it very... I don't speak French very well, so I think it was my fault. I found it very, very agonising, really.
Agonising?
I would say so.
Now, also, you used to fret about clothes because you go to these events and parties and everyone, as you say, was wearing couture, and obviously you couldn't afford that. So you found amazing dressmakers who would go through Vogue and the like and copy clothes, which sounds incredible.
Well, I had a good dressmaker who lived near us in Chelsea. She was Cypriot, very, very nice girl, very clever. and it was very cheap. So I used to buy the Officiel, which was the, I don't know whether it's still going or not, big, like Vogue rather, with all the photographs of the haute couture in Paris and Italy and everything. Then I would buy them, spend the money on buying the material.
Quality fabric.
The actual material that I saw in the picture. And then Virginia would make the dress.
Fabulous. So you, nobody knew.
Well, I don't know. I'm sure they did. I'm sure they did.
The hem's not quite straight.
No, there you are, she.
In the late 60s, your husband was introduced to the Rolling Stones, who were nearly broke and had tax problems, and he became their business manager. He made them financially stable. Did you get close to Mick or Keith?
Well, I know them all very well, yes, very well. After all, my husband worked for them for, I suppose, 34, 35 years. So
I imagine they're very grateful to Rupert for, you know, stabilising them.
I think they were. I think they were. I think so.
So in the book, you seem to enjoy Keith's company. You found him entertaining, even though he had a meltdown before and went on stage because someone ate his shepherd's pie.
Yes. Well,
can you tell us
story?
Can you tell us about them individually? What?
Well, I think contrary to what people might think, they're really quite they're clever and they're well read, and a good company, and well, all of them. Charlie Watts, he loves the ballet. We used to talk about the ballet all the time.
Fabulous.
Yes. Oh, yes. And, no, I'm very fond of them all.
Yeah.
Very fond.
Yeah. So they're cultured.
Yes, I think, especially, yes, I think Mick and Keith and Charlie, yes.
So you could have interesting conversations and, yeah. So it wasn't just all rock and roll.
Oh, no, not at all.
Now, as you were kind of in now kind of high society and cafe society, and you decided, in fact, I saw it because of the photographs in your beautiful book, you had an all-white ball. Can you tell us about that party?
Well, we thought we'd give a ball. I don't know really why, but in the 60s, people gave massive parties all the time. So we decided to give a party in the garden at Holland Villas Road. We had a marquee. It was quite a big garden. And then we asked all the people, and it was just a great success, luckily.
And who came that we will have heard of?
Oh, goodness, no.
Well, I know that Mick was there.
Cecil Beaton. Princess Margaret.
All white was the theme. What did you
wear? I thought white would be a good thing to have a theme. Mm. And I think people look their best in white, myself. I always think that.
Yeah.
And so they all turned up in white, except in Marianne Faithfull, you know, to Mick's girlfriend. She came in black.
It was a statement.
It looked quite good, actually, in a way, you know. It was quite a good thing to do.
Yeah, yeah.
It was funny, anyway.
Yeah, excellent. Gosh, brilliant. So you talk a lot about travel and holidays in the book. I love the way in most countries you end up meeting royalty and the Raj, and the disaster stories are hilarious. Can you tell us about staying with the Raj in India? I think that was my favourite story.
Well, which particular one?
The one where it was all... Well, ones where it all goes horribly wrong.
Well, I suppose it's difficult to remember. I think it was Gwalior. The Maharaja of Gwalior. We started off there. We went to Bombay and then we went on to Gwalior. And there they had all the servants in full dress, or, you know, hundreds of them. And then you had one sleeping outside your door on the floor, you know, in case you in the night. And then I had breakfast in my bedroom, and then about five of them came in with the breakfast on a trolley, and then when they laid it on the table, they went and stood against the wall in
terrifying.
A row, staring at me.
Yeah.
And so there was cereal with boiled milk, which is one of my horrors, with skin on it, you know. And they just watched. I had to eat it in front of them.
Gosh, it's like being a kind of 18th century queen or something.
Yeah, it was strange, wasn't it? But that's how they lived then. I don't know about now. Perhaps it still goes on.
Yeah, probably there's only about one person in the room compared to five.
I don't know. Well, everybody wants a job there, don't they?
Yeah, true, true.
You know, they need it for things.
You also said that some places, they might have been palaces, but they were dirty.
Yes, they were. Mm. Because they have different groups of people who do the things, you know. The things like the cleaning will be done by they're called the untouchables. And if they're not there or anything happened, then it would be left. Nobody else could do it.
Ridiculous.
They weren't allowed to. Oh. Everybody does their own job.
Ridiculous.
Which is very interesting again.
Yeah, mm. Yeah. I remember you saying you were so happy when you went to kind of like the Western Hotel and had a proper bath.
Oh, my goodness, yes. I know, but they were so hospitable and nice. They were the Maharajas, so cultivated and fascinating.
No, I really want to go there. Now, also, you went to Russia at the height of the Cold War, which sounded quite a terrifying place. Can you tell us about that?
It was, rather, yes. Well, you were watched all the time, you know. You couldn't walk anywhere. You couldn't stop on the street. You stopped on the street corner wondering where to go next or something. Then the police would come up and move you on or say, can I help you or something. And it was March. It was unbelievably cold. It was 25 degrees below zero. I've never been in that cold before. It's absolutely extraordinary.
And probably terrible food as well.
Well, they're rather non-existent, yes. Mm. Sort of very simple, like cabbage soup and some chicken or something.
And there was nothing in the shops and no sign of advertising.
At all. Mm. People queuing up at the shop to buy an orange, and they have numbers stamped on their hands so they don't get out of the queue.
Oh, how sad.
So you stand... things like that were rather terrible, really.
Yeah.
Mm. But no traffic, no neon lights, nothing modern.
So actually quite nice.
Beautiful.
In that way. Yeah, because you see the city as it was.
Yes, yeah. Absolutely unspoiled.
Yeah. Yeah, you can imagine horses and carriages coming
along. Really loved all that.
Quiet. Yeah.
It's absolutely wonderful. Mm. Mm.
So you still love travel, and there's somewhere you go every year because you have a house there. It's Mustique. Which is a private island in the Caribbean, which was made fashionable by the eccentric Scottish aristocrat Lord Glenconner. Can you tell us about your love of Mustique?
Well, I think, again, it's because it's unspoiled. It's very small, 3 miles long and 1.5 miles wide. Quite a lot of houses now, but they don't show too much. So they're all very nicely done. And white beaches... Very few people, really.
Sounds wonderful.
They kept it completely exclusive.
Mm-hmm. And when you went there at first, I mean, you were the first people really to go there, weren't you? You made it fashionable.
Well, I don't know about that. We were the first people to stay in the hotel, yes, which was formerly a cotton house. Beautiful 18th century building. And they built an annex. Oliver Messel, the decorator, he built an annex, and we were the first people to stay in that. It was lovely.
And you also were the first person to build a villa there, weren't you?
Well, no, the villa was already there. Mm. Again, an Oliver Mistel house. But the middle was quite small. There were two lodges either side, which I left, and I took the middle bit down, made it a bit bigger. Same thing, only bigger. And had verandas round, because you have the air has to circulate. You know, otherwise you get, it's really hot.
Mm. Now, it's famous for Princess Margaret, the Rolling Stones. Everybody went there. So, basically, it was your friends, wasn't it?
Yes, I suppose so. Yes. It was. I mean, it was when Colin was running it, and it was like just like a house party, you know. You might be staying with somebody in a country house, and all the people, you'd know all the people.
So, was it constant kind of drinks, parties, dressing up, frolics?
Yes, all that sort of thing. Yes.
Barbecues, picnics.
Beautifully done. Oh, it's fantastic. And, but on the other hand, nowadays, you don't have to go out if you don't want to. Mm-hmm. You know, people will ring up and ask you for dinner, and they'll say, how many will you be? You know, you can say five or four or whatever. And then you don't have to go if you don't want to.
But there's probably not many places to go still there, are there?
No, you just go to dinner at the villa, one of the houses.
Yeah.
People
so
rent
it's all
houses.
About who you know, then. I mean, as in, you'd have to know people. If you went there and didn't know anyone, you wouldn't. The there'd be nowhere to go, sort of.
Yeah, well, no, but I mean, you wouldn't go there unless you knew somebody.
Yeah.
Or other.
Yeah.
I think.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think I would have. Well, yes, just to see it.
Yeah.
It's quite beautiful.
And when you first went there, it was really hard to get to. Didn't you have to take a little aeroplane?
You have to take the little aeroplane now. But then you flew to St. Vincent, and then you had to take a boat.
Oh.
Yes.
It was a boat. It wasn't an airport.
No, not at the beginning.
Yeah,
no.
Yeah. Wow. So it must have taken hours to get there.
Well, it was quite a journey, yes.
Yeah, yeah.
A bit dependent on the weather as well.
Yeah, yeah. And when is the weather good there?
Well, it's good all the time, except the September, October is the hurricane time, if there is a hurricane. But generally speaking, they have very few there.
Lovely.
Which is very lucky.
And you still go there every Christmas?
I go for Christmas. And we used to go in the summer as well. But we let the house quite a lot. Mm-hmm. Everybody does.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. It's a way of keeping people
keeping going.
Jobs.
Yes,
and
the staff.
And the upkeep.
And the staff like it and enjoy it. And
wonderful.
And you get renters that come take it maybe again the next year and several years running or something.
Exactly.
Yes.
Exactly. So can you tell us about Lord Glenconner? Because he sounds like he had a little bit of a temper.
Well, yeah, it's putting it extremely mildly. Now, I wrote about him in my book quite extensively. And then I gave Anne, his wife, Anne Glenconner, showed her the things I'd written.
Yeah, just in case.
Oh, well, I know. You have to be careful. You don't want to hurt anyone's feelings. And she was thrilled with it all. So that was very lucky.
The honesty.
She didn't mind a bit.
Can you tell us about Princess Margaret? Because obviously she was, I think, from the outside, she seems like she was the most fun royal. Is that true?
Well, that's a difficult thing to answer, I'm afraid.
Oh.
A very, very good friend. Mm. Very devoted friend, kind, sympathetic, if she liked you. But if not...
You knew about it.
It was another matter.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yes, yeah. Yes. No, I was very fond of her.
Great.
But my husband and her, they were very, very, very close friends and very, very interested in history and all the whole thing like that, you know?
Lovely.
She was very, very knowledgeable about many things. And she wasn't. She had a wild side, but...
And then who didn't in those days? It was the height
that
of...
that was the days. Mm.
It was the height of the kind of cultural revolution in Britain.
It was, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. And you were so lucky with that.
Well, lucky, wasn't it? Yes.
Yeah. No, great. Mm. I do think the 20th century, really one of my favourite times.
Yeah.
Now, after a few years, you gave birth to a daughter, Dora. Can you tell us about Dora?
Well, Dora, yes, she's been very a wonderful daughter. You couldn't wish for a better one. She'd been very successful, good, wonderful business brain from her father, I expect.
And she, maybe from your mother.
Yeah. Who's to know? Mm. Who's to know?
Mm.
Yes, she was brilliant and no trouble at all.
She sounds like she was very grown up for her age in the book, you know.
Yes.
She sounds like she was wise beyond her years.
Yes, you're right. Very sensible.
Yeah.
Very, very sensible. And then she went to a kindergarten school, which is over the road from us, when she was about three or four. And then at five, she had to move on to another school. And then she started weeping when she left the little school. And I said, "What did you love it so much?" And she said, "No, but I don't know what they're going to do without me."
Wow, the sense of responsibility.
Wasn't that amazing at that age?
Yeah,
I know.
Yeah.
Now, you see, that's the sort of thing I like to write down because it's so funny.
Yes, yes.
Isn't
it's extraordinary, extraordinary. So let's just go back to, your faith. And you converted, obviously your husband was a Catholic, but then you converted to Catholicism. Can you tell us about that?
Well, when I lived in Rome, I was... a cousin of mine came over and he said, "Would I like to come out for dinner?" And he brought this priest friend who was studying at the Beda, which is where they study, priests study in Rome. And we went out to dinner. And when I saw the priest, I knew immediately I'd become a Catholic. Just
What was it like? You had a spiritual feeling?
Well, yes. I did, yeah. Mm. Yeah, I did. Mm. And when I saw his face, I knew that was it. So he became a great friend and he married us.
Oh.
I married Dora.
Oh, how wonderful.
And I think christened some of the children.
Mm.
So that was nice. He only died about 2 years ago.
Oh, how lovely. Yes. So you literally did have a spiritual experience and it brought you
I did. It'll hit me like that.
Yeah. And has Catholicism helped you in your life?
Oh, I think it's absolutely wonderful, yes. It's a wonderful structure. And you always can, you know, go back to it and follow the rules best you can. And I think it's a very good thing, a base. I think you've got to have a religious base, no matter what.
The opposite of your mother, then?
Opposite.
Yeah, yeah. Yes. Very interesting. So both your sons are now in the church. Was this, I mean, after you've told me all this about your love for the church, I was asking, is it a surprise to you? So maybe it isn't a surprise because you have these strong, passionate feelings about the church. Maybe, you know, they got them from you.
Yes. Mm. Well, I don't know about that. My husband was very religious. Mm. He was one of the leading Catholics in this country, and he was president of the Order of Malta, and he was, I think, president of the Aid Church in Need, and all kinds of things like that. But my eldest son was always a teacher, he was a mathematics teacher, a very tough life, incomprehensives and all that sort of thing. And then I expected him to go into the church. When we lived in Holland Village Road, he was about 8 then, and there was a convent next door. He was always standing on the wall talking to the nuns, very often.
Lovely.
Yes.
Didn't he announce to you that he was going to become one?
Well, that was later on. Oh. That was yes. I can't remember how old he was then. Oh. 20s, I suppose.
Okay.
Mm.
So does he live in Italy now?
No, the other son does.
Oh, I see. Sorry, yes. I got muddled up which one.
He lives in North London.
Yeah. So he's the teacher at the girls' school now?
Yes.
That's right.
Yes. He teaches full time.
Yeah.
Mm.
And your other son, how did he come to the church?
I don't know why.
Mm.
I don't know. Mm. But he's in... he lives in Italy, by and large.
Oh, that's the one. That's
and he had his church. Had a church of his own for 12 years.
And they're both Catholic priests.
Yes.
So stayed in the same religion. Yeah. So did you feel that you ever lost them when they became kind of monks?
Well, I was... when my eldest son became a priest, yes, I did. I wasn't against it, but I was...
Bereft.
Exactly. Mm. Mm. Yeah. But I think it suits them, really, I suppose, you know.
Mm. So you live in you've lived in many gorgeous houses, but the house we're in now and the one that you've loved best is Petersham Lodge, where we are now. Why is it so perfect for you here?
Well, I don't know. I fell in love with it the first minute I saw it, really. My son Conrad, my younger son, he knew the people that lived here. And he said, you know, you really ought to see that house. It's just so wonderful. And he asked them if he could bring me for tea. It wasn't for sale.
Oh,
and I came.
I like where he'd already thought about it for you.
And then we came here and it was just love at first sight. And I couldn't sleep. My heart was pounding for days, and I thought, I've got to have that. I knew it was meant, in a way.
Mm-hmm.
And then about a year later, it was for sale. I wrote to the lady, and I said, you know, if you ever want to sell it, let me know. And she did. And then I planned it all without telling my husband, because I knew he wouldn't want to move, really. And he didn't, and he was...
Because you were unhappy in the country, but he liked it there.
Yeah. He liked it. Mm. Well, I think a lot of men don't like change, do they? You know, they settle in and that's it. But he liked it in the end.
Great. Well, it is beautiful. It has a kind of very beautiful, large private garden. Mm. So you're now in your 80s. We haven't mentioned piano, which I do want to talk about just briefly. You keep yourself active by you play the piano every day and you walk your... dogs, yes. Who I've met, who are very lively. Do you think this is the key then to why you are so still alert and young?
Well, I think the music helps a lot because it's, well, you know, it's a bit like mathematics, isn't it? You know, reading and that sort of thing. And I love it too. I do about 2 hours a day.
2 hours a day?
Occasionally three, if I'm lucky. I take the dogs for about an hour's walk every morning. Mm. And I try to, I eat very, very carefully. Mm-hmm. And when I go on holiday, I eat what I like. But when I'm at home, I'm on a constant, careful regime,
I'd say. Yes. Very good. So moderation, exercise, and using the brain.
Well.
So I'd love to know what your motto for life is.
I think to keep going at all costs and not to let yourself go physically or mentally.
And how seriously should we take life?
Not too seriously.
Thank you so much. Wind in My Hair, A Kaleidoscope of Memories is published by Dovecot Press. Thank you so much, Josephine, for coming on to Radio Gorgeous.
Thank you. It was a pleasure.
This is a Radio Gorgeous production for Radio Gorgeous 2016. For more information, go to radiogorgeous.com.